Good morning and welcome to the March 12, 2013 meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. I ask you to please rise and join us in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, we'll remind you that the clerk has hearing devices for those that need them, and I would also remind you to get your speaker slips in because we want to go through public comment as quickly as we can to get on with the business of the day. Madam Clerk, any changes to the agenda?
Addendum to item number 9, land application of treated sewage sludge biosolids. The wrong negative declaration document was attached and is now corrected. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour notice requirement.
Thank you. We'll move right into public comment on the agenda. I've got one request to speak, Mr. Greening, on item number 1.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and this is an item to cancel a meeting that happens during a week when there will be apparently a large emergency training exercise going on. I have a couple of questions and a comment. My question is it the intent of at least a quorum of the board at some time during that week to actually be assembled in one conversation? And if so, does the public need access to that conversation unless certain findings for a closed session under the Brown Act can be made? Then I would think it would be necessary to accommodate the public. If it's simply the meeting is simply being canceled because staff will be unavailable, being completely caught up in this, then I completely understand it. And in any event, I do support the cancellation for such an important thing as working on being ready for anything. As a sort of a quid pro quo for the canceled meeting, I would ask for a thorough report out, an agendized item at a subsequent meeting to report on the strengths and weaknesses, what was working, what wasn't, what are the learning curves, how can the public help and engage. So please, if you do cancel this meeting, you owe us a thorough hearing. Obviously, when we think of emergencies, particularly on the second anniversary of the Fukushima crisis, we think particularly about the nuclear plant in our midst and the various things that could happen that are not currently being expected, that were not expected in Japan. And, of course, a lot of it is simply planning for duration. We're 2 years out on Fukushima, and there are still people dislocated, receiving no assistance whatsoever because they're in that sort of ambiguous zone where it's not a complete flat-out evacuation, but things keep being discovered that make them reluctant to return to their lives. But if they don't return to their farms, what do they live on? They're farmers. You know, I mean, we've got all kinds of situations like this. We are a county that is extremely vulnerable both to the reality of contamination and the perception and fear of contamination. If people get reluctant to buy agricultural products from this area in the wake of an accident, if people become reluctant to visit because of in the wake of an accident, that's our two biggest economic supports right there. And so we need to be looking not just at immediate emergency response, even though there's a lot of work to be done, but also at a long term. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. I have no further request to speak on consent. We'll go into bring it back to the board for comments or items that they would like to pull. I'll start to my right with Mr. Meacham.
I have none to pull. Thank you, sir.
Ms. Arnold?
No.
Mr. Gibson?
None, sir.
Mr. Hill?
None, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Move to approve the consent calendar.
Second.
Roll call vote, Madam Clerk.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Teixeira?
Yes. Thank you. We'll move into general public comment. I've got quite a few here to look at. We'll start with Brian Stacey.
Energy seismic surveys were the surveys, and I think I'm fairly certain that it will be proved out that they have enough information currently to comply with relicensing of Diablo Canyon and AB 1632. I don't know for sure, but they never appealed the decision by Coastal Commission on Hess. So it would common sense would say, had they needed it, they would have appealed the next day. They would have fought for the Hess instead of just letting it die on the vine like they did. So I implore you to put an end to this nightmare that my life has become and call for an audit of those monies so we can see what happened there. I know my business wasn't mitigated at all, and I know other commercial fishermen weren't either. I'm the former vice president of Port San Luis Commercial Fishermen's Association. My board never shared any information that they got any money. My members sent me to battle for them on Hess. So, and some of you I've had meetings with in regards to Hess. I did my best job. I represented fishermen like nobody ever has in this county. So I was honest. That's rare in my industry. And that's from sharing information with each other when we're fishing to high energy seismic surveys. A lot of people in my business just don't shoot straight. So I do. I just stay honest and focused, and I've experienced the wrath of that. Don't be too honest in this world. Thank you very much. Please call for an audit.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Stacey. Ben DeFada, followed by Eric Greening and Lindy Owen.
Good morning, Chairman Teixeira, Board, Sheriff, and public. Ben DeFada here from Supervisor Gibson's District 2, town of Los Osos. While throwing out a pile of papers from several years ago, I ran across Gibson's campaign literature of 2006. Can't remember whether it was before or after the Wilcox Ed scandal. Basically, it said, I'm running for county supervisor because I believe we can shape our own future if we come together to holding county government accountable. Okay, Bruce, you said it, not us. The voters want yourself accountable for embarrassing yourself, your constituents, your family, and this whole county without any kind of punishment to you. We want you to make the right decision and resign from the board immediately. Besides the above, you even teamed up with the other two, making a majority of three comrades, and together with other good old boys passed anything any one of you three brought up on this board without any kind of challenge. Not even taking any action against Pablo Ogren and his sweetie, who at the time was vice chair of the Los Osos CSD, having pillow talk about how to get the Los Osos CSD bankrupt and out of the way from Gibson Ogren's very expensive flawed gravity sewer project. Except for Supervisor Meacham, this board passed the Los Osos sewer project without any of you other two comrades asking Gibson the hard questions, or hardly any questions for that matter. You approved his antiquated, overpriced, unaffordable, energy hog, stinking gravity project that nobody can afford. It looks like what was going to be a $25,000 assessment per lot, it's now about $40,000 assessment per lot. Of course, the public will never know the true cost of the project till it's just about done. So much for transparency. You really want to know why we come here every Tuesday? Well, when the county took over the Los Osos sewer project, it made sure that the Los Osos CSD can't get involved anymore in the sewer. So we had to come here and remind you that putting the sewer in the middle of town is a bad idea, that a $200 million project was unaffordable, that a million gallons of water a day on sandy soil high above the central part of town was not a good idea, that placing the treatment plant way outside of the town's basin was a bad idea, and using spray fields to get rid of the town's only drinking water, never to be seen again, was a bad idea, and so forth. I don't have enough time to mention other things at this time. Talk about decisions by Gibson and Ogden. Los Osos has endured a lot of abuse, But one that none of us will ever forget is the one that former Supervisor Bianchi, when she said, "You can't cross a creek with a sewer pipe." That was the reason why the sewer plant had to be built in the center of town. Well, that's about the time the citizens rebelled and recalled all three of their CSD directors in disgrace. So you see what comes of what the likes of three comrades on this
Thank
court
you,
can
Mr.
do
DeFatta.
In ruin the town. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Eric Greening, followed by Lindy Owen and Mike Brown.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I guess I'll start by referring back to a slightly earlier public comment that reinforces a point I was just making. People in agriculture, people who own hotels and other visitor-serving businesses, if you expect that in the wake of something going California Environmental Quality Act, because I am very concerned that what is being touted as streamlining is actually special favors for the politically connected under the rubric of smart growth. And I note that in the list in SB 731, I'm waiting for some of the spot bills to fill in with the actual detail that will enact some of this, but it's pretty well outlined in Steinberg's SB 731. In the class of projects for which he wants streamlining or exemption is something called advanced manufacturing projects. I don't know what that is. My fear is that it may be nanotechnology. And if that is the case, the question is, would we rather be in ignorance about the impacts and then find out later? Or would we rather be precautionary and study up front, which CEQA is meant to do? CEQA isn't meant to just stop everything. It's not meant as an obstacle. It's meant to give us the information to weigh our decisions on the costs and benefits of the project by understanding the environmental costs. Reminds me of a bumper sticker that you see sometimes in the education community. If you think education costs too much, try ignorance. It applies not just to schools, but to environmental law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Lindy Owen, followed by Mike Brown, and David Broadwater, and Bill Clark.
Good morning. Lindy Owen from Los Osos. I would like to start off with a serious request that the legislative analysts, we need a job description. I think the salary is extremely high when you remember that the secretary that took care of all five supervisors' meetings and coordinating many things makes under $40,000 a year. I'm not comfortable with an at-will employee. If it's going to be at-will, I think each supervisor should be able to pay their at-will assistant out of their own salary. And then the discussion about what this is costing and Mr. Gibson's concern, I think Mr. Gibson needs to pay for the cost of what it's taken to do investigation to see where the wrongdoings are with having an affair with your legislative assistant secretly for 6 years. Then I kind of want to go back to why I believe that we come here every week, and I actually take pride in being a watchdog because I've seen what happens in government when there are no watchdogs and when people are silenced. And so I will jump out of my skin a little and say, is this Gibson, Ogren, and Wallace County? Because that's who I feel is running the county business at this point. And it's up to all five of you to make sure that you do the people's work and that everything that is done is for the county. Again, there's no oversight on the Los Osos Sewer Project. This is a project that Sam Blakesley took away from an operating and elected, freshly seated CSD that was intending to do an alternative green technology. And instead, we went back once Blakesley gave it to the county and Mr. Ogren got hold of it with Mr. Gibson's assistance. They went back to the same thing that we'd already spent $35 million developing a very flawed program. And now, if you think it was flawed to begin with, it's been reworked and copy-pasted so many times that it's a complete mess. I'm requesting that we do some flow tests in the pipes that have already been installed because it doesn't look like they're putting them to the depths that they were supposed to. And I am, of course, not an engineer, but I think it makes sense with over $200 million project that somebody go in at some point and try to get some oversight going. And I'm not very comfortable with Mr. Ogren and Mr. Gibson's choice of John Waddell. He is one person, and we need somebody that's overlooking all the problems that are going on in Los Osos. And I don't want this to backfire on this county because that's who's going to end up looking bad when it does fail. So please look into the legislative assistant. I think that's a position that needs a description.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Mike Brown, followed by David Broadwater and Bill Clark, and that's my last request to speak.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. I asked the clerk to pass out a copy of the new Senate Bill Number 1 from Senator Steinberg. It's mostly a repeat of SB 1156 from last year, which you may remember the governor ultimately vetoed 1156. This was sort of, both bills are sort of couched as well. Redevelopment has gone away, and now pledge the tax increment from these entities to service that debt, and even work with various pension authorities, including PERS, STERS, the 37 Act pension, and it specifically calls out independent pensions such as yours to be invested in these entities. So it's quite clever. We think that you ought to agendize it as a legislative program matter and have a full discussion here before you take any position with CSAC or whatever on it. It could be a massive way to implement smart growth doctrine, execute provisions far beyond anything you could imagine. Of course, divert growth from the general fund and be a great burden on everybody and further the purposes of some of these things that are highly problematical. So we think it deserves a full discussion here in public.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. David Broadwater, followed by Bill Clark, and that's my last request to speak this morning.
Good morning, Board, and Mr. Chairman. My name is David Broadwater from Atascadero. I came down here this morning to speak on agenda item number 9 about slinging toxic sewage sludge on land, but I wanted to be among the folks who spoke out about the toxic sludge that gets spewed around in these chambers from time to time from some of the members of the public. And I just wanted to, I was aware and have seen some of the comments that have been made regarding a legislative aid of one of yours. And I just want to be among those who express my support for your board's ability to enforce decorum and rules regarding the content of public speech during public comment. And just to quote from your own rules of procedure, under public comment, the rule is no person will be permitted to make slanderous or profane remarks against any individual. And I'm a strong supporter of the First Amendment as well as the Brown Act. But you're aware that the Brown Act allows you to set rules for decorum and procedure as long as they don't interfere with the public's right to speak. And I'm also read in the news that one of your supervisors, Supervisor Gibson, I think it was during that same meeting, made a statement about possibly shortening the public comment period, and I'm aware of Mr. Meacham's statement, saw it, that these are business meetings. I just want to say that part of your business is during public comment to receive information and perspectives that may not have occurred to you or you might not have been informed of. You and your staff don't know everything that's going on, and you need to have the public to be able to inform you about important things that are occurring within your jurisdiction. And so I would be very careful and very much opposed to any shortening of public comment whatsoever. There's no need for that. And so I encourage you not to go forward with any kind of an idea like that. That's not the problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Broadwater. Bill Clark, and that's my final request to speak on public comment this morning.
Yes, thank you. My name is Bill Clark, and I live on Tassajara Canyon Road in Santa Margarita. And neighbor and I got to talking about the upcoming Santa Margarita area Board of Council Committee, Advisory Council Committee, and the elections are coming up. Traditionally, they're the second Tuesday in April. And we surmised that maybe not too many people along the canyon there knew about the election coming up, and one thing led to another, and we came up with a bunch of suggestions that we think might increase participation in the elections. And although most of my suggestions, I think, are pertinent mostly to the 5th District, because that's the area I know, some of these comments might apply to the other districts as well. First of all, I think there needs to be effective notification of the elections. That first of all, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., which I think cuts out quite a number of people that have to work on Tuesdays. Perhaps the time could be split, perhaps more like 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., and then maybe again 4 p.m. to 7 p.m., or at least 2 p.m. to 7 p.m., something that would accommodate people that have to work during the day. Perhaps the elections could be held on a Saturday rather than a Tuesday, which I think would accommodate more people. And the second Tuesday in April actually isn't the best time to have the elections. A lot of people are on spring vacation. So that brings up the idea of perhaps a method for absentee voting.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Appreciate your comments.
Thank you.
That concludes public comment for this morning. I'll close it at this time. Seeing no further requests to speak, Madam Clerk, would you introduce the next item, please?
Item number 9, consideration of a request for direction on three options for amending, replacing San Luis Obispo County Code Chapter 8.13, land application of treated sewage sludge biosolids.
Thank you. And we have Mr. Lichtenfeld and staff here. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the board. Good morning. Richard Lichtenfeld, County Environmental Health Services. the health agency is before you this morning to seek direction on how to proceed with the regulations that govern the land application of biosolids. Before we jump into the topic, just some minor housekeeping. The terms sewage, treated sewage, sludge, and biosolids will be used this morning by different folks. For our purposes this morning, the terms are synonymous. Just to give the board some background with regard to biosolids land application, across the United States, biosolids are land applied in all states. Nationwide, about 50% of all biosolids are being recycled to land. These biosolids are used on less than 1% of the nation's ag land. In the state of California, 65% of the generated biosolids are land applied. In San Luis Obispo County, from a survey done in 2010, the county's 17 wastewater treatment plants produced approximately 11,500 tons of biosolids. And of this 11,500 tons, some 2,600 tons were disposed of in county landfills. Another 2,800 tons, or about 25%, is trucked to San Joaquin Valley to be mixed with green waste. The remaining 51%, equaling about 6,100 tons, is being trucked to a composting facility in Santa Maria. Be advised that all of the county's wastewater treatment plants produce a Class B biosolid. So to back up just a little bit, there are two. There's a federal standard that created two classes of biosolids that could be land applied, Class A and Class B. Right now, our interim ordinance that's currently in effect allows only Class A EQ, which means exceptional quality. Some folks who are not initiated in the world of biosolids may snicker when we use the word exceptional quality, but that's the way the EPA came up with that. So in this county, we only allow the application of EQ, exceptional quality biosolids, via our interim ordinance. Two ordinances will be discussed and presented this morning. We have a draft permanent ordinance that is under consideration, perhaps, except that we are actually recommending that the in-place interim ordinance be extended through 2017. So if Leslie, before we get to the ordinance timeline, if you would put up the three options that are presented to the board this morning. The Public Health Department is requesting direction from the board regarding the following three options. Number one, extend the existing land application of treated sewage sludge biosolids interim ordinance until March 2017, which is our recommendation. Number two, make the existing land application of treated sewage sludge biosolids interim ordinance the permanent biosolids ordinance. Or number three, move forward with the new draft biosolids ordinance with the intention of permanently replacing the existing interim ordinance. If we could go to the timeline. So back in 1998, when I was a young man with hair, short of an opinion, but they did a real public service, and I know some of the folks who were involved with that task force are here this morning and will probably comment. So the public task force made recommendations to the original Board of Supervisors in 2001. Probably the most important thing to remember from the recommendations that came from the task force was the fact that, bottom line, they wanted to see more stringent regulations imposed by the county, more stringent than the federal and state regulations. And so that was our marching orders and our direction that came from the Board of Supervisors back at that time. So in 2002, the Board of Supervisors directs Public Health Department to create a local ordinance. At that time, we did reconvene the task force to help us put together what's now called the interim ordinance, and which currently is in effect. And the word, we've kind of abused the word interim, I guess you could say. It's been interim since 2004, and so we're sneaking up on a permanent ordinance at some point in time. In 2004, the board enacted the ordinance with an expiration date of 2006. We came back to the board in 2006, and for various reasons, we did not have a permanent ordinance to present. So the interim ordinance was extended another 48 months until 2010. Most of you were here, or several of you were here in 2010 when the board deferred in 2009 the permanent ordinance development process due to concerns regarding the estimated cost of an EIR, which was very expensive. And as we speak, it gets more expensive each year. So in 2010, the Board of Supervisors extended the interim ordinance for another 48 months, which will end next year in 2014. So that's where we are today. We have the three options in front of your board. We'll be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Lichtenfels. Questions for Rich or Steph? right now, Mr. Gibson?
If I could, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In you had referenced a permanent ordinance. We have a draft of it in the staff report. Is that something that's under active consideration at this point? And if so, what are the issues that are being considered? I mean, it's got draft marked on it.
Yes, Mr. Gibson.
Things you're moving forward on?
It currently is a draft. It's in draft form. It has not been released officially for public comment. Depending on the direction from your board, if you so choose for us to move forward with a permanent ordinance, it would be disseminated to the public and for comment. And right. So right now it's just in the staff report for informational purposes.
Okay, but it's not currently actively under discussion,
no,
I take
that's
that.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Further comments from the board? Mr. Buckshire.
If I may, Mr. Lichtenfeld, I think it might be helpful if you could just provide a brief overview of what's included or not included in the interim ordinance and what would be different about the permanent ordinance that's listed as an option as well. Just hit the highlights of each and what
the differences are. That's a good point, Mr. Buckshire. Probably the basic difference between the two ordinances is the fact that the interim ordinance does not address composted biosolids. In our infinite wisdom back in the day, we decided not to include composted biosolids as being regulated. The draft permanent ordinance does include composted biosolids. Probably the most important thing to remember is how conservative both the draft and the currently in place interim ordinance are. They're very conservative. They require exceptional quality biosolids. Throughout the nation, EQ biosolids really don't require much government oversight because it's treated basically as a fertilizer. So our marching orders at the Public Health Department was to protect public health, and so that was our direction.
Thank you. Mr. Meacham?
Thank you. Rich, are there any restrictions on what comes back into our county in terms of the byproduct? I mean, I know that some fertilizers come back in. You can get them at Home Depot. You can get them in other areas. What regulates that coming back into our area?
Well, the interim ordinance has in place what we used was historical values at the time we put it together, and that was 1,500 cubic yards per year. So we can, straight biosolids can be applied as long as it's EQ up to 1,500 cubic yards per year. Now, if we don't use all of that 1,500 cubic yards in a 12-month period, you can roll over to the next year. Probably.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Supervisor Arnold?
Yes. Rich, when you were talking, when you were giving us our historical timeline, which I appreciated, back in 1998, 20,000 tons, it was a project coming into San Miguel. Mm-hmm. That would have been material from outside the county then, right? It's such a big volume, I thought it must have been that we were, that other places were looking to.
You know, Ms. Arnold, you know, to be honest, I don't recall.
I'm just looking at the, unless I misheard you, our 17 wastewater treatment plants produce 11,500 tons.
That's right.
And then you were talking about 20,000 tons, so right, I thought. We must have been targeted for maybe importation of, and that was maybe the what prompted the first ordinance that, well, it, we
right.
would be a receiving site for the state.
Well, we should always be proud that our biosolids are much better than anybody
yeah,
else.
Yeah, that's it.
Right?
Because it's
we should
my,
be very proud. So
you would know more about this than me, but.
The concern is that L.A. County mm-hmm. and that those the large urban industrialized counties, their biosolids aren't nearly as clean as ours, and
right.
so that's a concern.
That's where I was going with this.
And so far it looks like we haven't had a problem in that regard. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if we've been lucky. Probably a good segue now is to talk about what's happened in surrounding counties, especially Kern County. In 2006, the electorate voted by an overwhelming 83%, I believe, to ban the land application of biosolids. That was 2006. They have not been able to enforce that that ban even today because they're in a massive legal battle with the city of Los Angeles and other counties in Southern California. And according to court reports and the legal pundits that we've seen, they're probably going to lose, Kern County will probably lose the band. What they're saying is that the court basically is if everybody decided to ban, every county decided to ban, then where is it going to go? The health department realizes that it's a benefit. It has beneficial aspects, and we encourage recycling and reuse. There's a state clean water CWMA, I forget what it stands for actually, but that requires recycling of waste product. And it looks like that would violate Kern County's ban. And so that's what's going on next door to us. It's been very costly. It's my understanding that Kern County has decided to take it to the state Supreme Court. And so they're determined, but it doesn't look promising. There's some others, some of our wastewater treatment operators might be able to comment on that as well.
Mr. Lichtenfels, when you're talking about a ban on biosolids, are we talking about the raw material or it mixed with mulch in a processed product? What reference are you?
It's my understanding that Kern County banned all biosolids to be land applied.
Thank you.
Just to comment a little further on Kern County situation, they have they've always been somewhat upset because they've been the so-called dumping ground for L.A. County and the city of L.A., and city of L.A. has a 4,000-acre farm called Green Acres Farm where they dispose of or actually land apply 200,000 tons per year of Southern California biosolids. And so that was, I think, part of the impetus for the electorate to vote against that.
Okay, thank you. Further comments? Then I'll open it to public comment. My first request to speak is Eric Greening, followed by Lindy Owen, David Broadwater, and David Hicks.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I do encourage you to take the staff recommendation option one. It is working, and what is working is that we are not targeted. You know, we're not just talking about what goes through people. We're talking about whatever goes down a drain. In an area like this, that can include household chemicals. It can even include things like the pharmaceuticals that go through people. But it doesn't tend to include a whole lot of industrial waste. The big cities are trying to get rid of stuff that no responsible grower would want on their crops. You know, I even question the so-called clean, the EQ, when you look at what's in it, when you look at the ability of pathogens to multiply under the right circumstances. Even that is something that most responsible growers would not want on their crops. But the stuff coming out of the cities is essentially toxic waste, and more people know it. And so we are able to successfully keep that stuff out of here with our numerical limit. We can't actually discriminate on place of origin by law, but we can set a numerical limit and a quality limit. For as long as we can, with what seems to be working reasonably well, which is the interim ordinance, it has kept the big players out with what everybody sees as toxic waste. And if I could just add one note that is relevant, I think your federal legislative platform needs to include opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Although the negotiations are secret, it is more and more apparent that it would allow international dumping and the preemption of all local regulation environmentally to protect our soil. Thank you.
Lindy Owen, followed by David Broadwater and David Hicks.
Lindy Owen from Los Osos. I urge you to take the option one to go ahead and extend the interim ordinance. But I also believe it's time to have that conversation. We're talking 17 sewer plants, and we basically send it to someone else. And at one point, I will just historically go back to the alternative green sewer in Los Osos was going to have a area where all the septage from septic tanks, they're completely different beasts, but all that septage would be pumped because we were only going to collect liquid off our septic tanks and treat that And then as the septic tanks needed to be filled, they would go out. And the idea was a type of incinerator, some kind of biological machine that's used, of course, in Europe, not in this country. We probably always need to look to Europe for innovation at this point. But it would break down enough of the septage from all the septic tanks on the north coast. And it was an option that would have brought in some income to help pay for what we are doing. And it would have created energy into a grid, which is where the plant is located now. All those options went out the door when we got stuck with the mega sewer. And they are still options, but I don't believe this county has the intention to go there. When you talk about an agronomic rate, that is the amount that, you know, we would come up with to how much we want to put on each farmland. It becomes dilution is the solution mentality, because over years, those heavy metals and all the toxins that are in that waste, and I will agree we probably have a cleaner waste stream than L.A. County and some of the more industrial areas, but it still builds up, and those are items that blow in our wind. They wash into our waterways. They never go away. They're toxins. So the idea of having a conversation about taking responsibility as a county, how are we going to address the waste that is produced in this county is a very important thing. And I would extend right now the interim, but please start a county. Invite people in, make it easy to discuss options, and look at what some other countries do, because the idea of incineration means we get rid of something. We lose some of the good points of that sludge, but basically I think we're further ahead if we're producing energy than we're getting a benefit. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. David Broadwater, followed by David Hicks, Bruce Keough, and Greg Kester.
Good morning again, Board. David Broadwater from Atascadero. I want to first off thank your staff in Mr. Buckshy's shop and in the Environmental Health Division of the Public Health Agency for continuing this matter from January 29th till today. And I also want to thank the members of agricultural and environmental organizations and civic leaders, including the Farm Bureau, Ag Liaison Board, Sierra Club, EcoSlow, Surf Riders, the Coast Keeper, North County Watch, the Creston Advisory Body, and the South County Advisory Council, who are all engaged in this issue and were enabled by that continuation to examine the options and submit recommendations today. As far as I can tell from looking at the comments, there's not one single comment that's not saying go ahead and approve the staff recommendation for option one to continue the ordinance. I want to bring your attention to the folder that I brought you. Since 1998, I've advised all members of the Board of Supervisors to have a sludge folder. And in that, you'll find my comments on this matter. As an added bonus, I've added into that a four-page handout which lists the contents of sewage sludge by category, so you have an accurate idea. The last page is nothing but the references from which that material is gathered. Those are all contaminants that are issues of concern across the academics, the amount of lead and mercury, and five times the copper and nickel than is found in current sewage sludge. So even though these are called, snicker, snicker, exceptional quality standards, not. And they're not based upon the quality of local sewage sludge, which we can do.
Thank you, Mr. Broadwater.
I urge you to go for option number one. Thank you.
David Hicks, followed by Bruce Keough, Greg Kester, and John Wallace.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the Board of Supervisors. I'm David Hicks. I'm the Deputy Director of Utilities for the City of San Luis Obispo. As you may know, the city is the largest producer of is the largest wastewater facility in the county, and we produce tertiary treated effluent, recycled water, and clean biosolids. The city supports the staff recommendation option number one of continuing the interim ordinance as a placeholder until a permanent ordinance can be developed. In a recent newspaper article, it talked just about the cost of an EIR being the obstacle for the development of a permanent ordinance. And while cost is always something we consider, it's really not what we consider the main problem or the main issue. EIRs already exist for this material, and so we feel it's unwarranted to pay a large amount of money for an EIR. In fact, the EPA and the state have developed EIRs, which are were developed for beneficial reuse of biosolids. The EPA also reviews biosolids or biosolids regulations every 2 years. So these aren't these regulations don't sit on the shelves. They're living, breathing things that get reviewed and will probably change in the future. Although they haven't changed lately, there's always an opportunity for that. Like I said, protective regulations, guidelines, ordinances, and EIRs already exist for this for land application, the beneficial reuse of biosolids. The city supports a reasonable and protective permanent ordinance when that happens for the beneficial reuse of this material. It's important that we look at what we produce in our county, all these kind of wastes, whether it's biosolids or anything else. And large and broader community goals such as climate change, such as waste minimization and sustainability all need to be considered when we look at these type of activities and these kind of issues. With that said, we look forward to working with county staff as this keeps moving forward. I was on the original stakeholder, so I still have my hair. I'm lucky, but I can attest to you that he at one time was young. I'd like to final up is that the city considers itself a steward for resources and the environment and these type of activities, and we look forward to moving forward with the beneficial reuse and the protective and fair and flexible use of these materials within the county. And again, I do recommend that you you take staff recommendations for option number one for extending the interim ordinance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hicks. Bruce Keough, followed by Greg Kester, John Wallace, and Joy Fitzhugh.
My name is Bruce Keough, and I'm the Wastewater Division Manager for the City of Morro Bay. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments on the ordinance in front of you today. I am here also to express city staff support for extension of interim ordinance until March of 2017, option one. Support for this interim ordinance is based on the fact that this ordinance has been in place since 2004 and it has proven successful in regulating the land application of biosolids as well as composted biosolids within Slo County. To my knowledge, there have been no issues associated with land application of biosolids within Slo County while the ordinance has been in place. By extending the interim ordinance, you will allow other agencies, other counties to develop their own ordinances, settle outstanding legal issues, and most importantly, continue to allow good science to weigh in on this issue. In addition, developing a permanent ordinance will place a tremendous burden on both your critical staff time as well as financially. The estimates for the EIR range as high as, well, I'm thinking $250,000 at a time when the county is struggling with fiscal issues. As stated by Mr. Hicks, I think most importantly, there have been numerous other studies and EIRs performed on the land application of biosolids by both US EPA and the California State Water Resources Control Board. An EIR is probably unwarranted at this time, but a review of those materials would probably be very helpful. By extending the interim ordinance, you allow the county to keep as many beneficial reuse options available for future consideration. I'm proud to say that the Morro Bay Cayucas Wastewater Treatment Plant developed a composted biosolids project that successfully operated for about 8 years. That project was recently discontinued due to operational considerations associated with a proposed plant upgrade. The project was developed with the input of both the Regional Water Quality Control Board as well as staff at Environmental Health and was consistent with the interim ordinance that's currently in place. We are able to compost between 30% and 50% of our annual biosolids production, and the citizens of the local communities were thrilled to use the end product and exceptional quality compost. The interim ordinance allowed projects like this to be
the sewage population of the state and has long been a proactive leader in wastewater treatment, recycled water, biosolids management, and climate change mitigation issues. I appreciate the opportunity to provide comments to you today on the biosolids ordinance options before you. While CASA does not believe that any of the ordinances are necessary, we do stand behind the wastewater agencies in the county and the county staff in supporting the extension of the interim ordinance. I'm aware that Mr. Broadwater has presented a dire future if biosolids are used. However, I assure these allegations are without basis and without scientific credibility. Decades of research at universities across the United States have formed the basis for the federal and state regulations, which not only supports the safety of land application, but also promotes it as a sustainable recycling practice. All of us who live in an urban environment contribute and produce wastewater and contribute to the challenges public agencies must address to ensure sustainable environmental solutions, which is our charge. The body of research has shown biosolids improve crop production, soil structure, moisture-holding capacity, and soil microbial populations. Furthermore, after 40 years under the Clean Water Act, there has not been a single documented instance of an adverse public health effect from the land application of biosolids. I served on the National Academy of Sciences Committee that reviewed the adequacy of the federal biosolids regulations and published our report in 2002. Reviewed reams of research and as well as allegations of harm similar to Mr. Broadwater's and found none of them substantiated by science or medical records. We noted the continuing need to conduct research and advancing the science, not because of any perceived notion of danger, that danger would be discovered, but because all environmental regulations need periodic review and due diligence to ensure they remain protective of human health and the environment. US EPA and the California State Water Board have done and continue to do that due diligence. I should note that litigation in Kern County has been ongoing but is coming to an end, and court decisions have underscored the safety of biosolids. The decisions acknowledge the research, the regulations, the Integrated Waste Management Act, while simultaneously confirming the boundaries around the extent to which county's police powers may be applied. I would urge the board to consider all sides of the question and recognize that the citizens of San Luis Obispo County will continue to produce wastewater in their communities. These communities, in turn, treat it to exceedingly stringent standards and must be allowed to recycle the biosolids in water so that future generations will have a cost-effective, sustainable means to manage their renewable resources. I'm happy to answer any questions now or in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kester. Questions from colleagues? Thank you very much. John Wallace, followed by Joy Fitzhugh, Lisa Mbonye, and Lisa Bedrogi, and that's my final request to speak. Mr. Wallace, good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I, like Rich and some of the others here, have worked on several of the biosolids task force over the last 15 years. I guess we were both much younger then, but we work with a number of agencies throughout the county with wastewater treatment plants, and the agencies that we work for all favor the extension of the interim ordinance, the option number one that you have. I think that will give us time to review more of the proposed permanent ordinance at a future time. It will hopefully eliminate some of perhaps the exaggerations that have been put forward, and also just allow some good science from other studies to enter the picture to help us draft a more particular and comprehensive ordinance. There has been, as Mr. Kester brought out, extensive state and federal review of the topic with extensive environmental reviews, and they review those studies every several years and make any adjustments that they need to the federal and the state regulations. I think that we should be able to vet those development of a permanent ordinance with organizations such as CASA, with the Water Board, with the state, and with the EPA, reach out from our local resources and make use of those, because if an EIR is $200,000, perhaps we can use those studies to mitigate and to append into our own document to mitigate some of that cost. I think also in closing, just briefly, we need to, I think, as a responsible county, look at using our resources that we generate here within our county. As you know, many of the plants transport these biosolids to Kern County and other areas, Santa Maria. I think it's time that we develop a program where we utilize the resources that were generated here and to help offset some of the transportation costs, the greenhouse gas generation that results from that. And so I think that that would be part of the next task force, if you will, in helping to look at those issues here for our county. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. Joy Fitzhugh, followed by Lisa Mbonye, and thank you, Ms. Fitzhugh. Lisa Mbonye, followed by Lisa Bedrogi.
Good morning, Board of Supervisors. My name is Lisa Bonnier, and I am a farmer. And I'm realizing I'm preaching here to the choir, but I'm for one do not like to kick the can down the road. But I think that in this case, I supporting option one. There is much more technology and information coming out, and as a county, we will benefit from that in the future. We should not open the doors to make this county a destination point for outside waste. San Luis Obispo ag land is not someone else's dumping ground. I do understand that we should come up with a solution for our own waste here, but perhaps not somebody else's waste. I do want to make a comment for Mr. Meacham about soiled bags coming back into this county. For some time now we have seen sludge being marketed in bags, and one of the brands that we have grown up with is Kellogg's. I think we all are familiar with Kellogg's. And they were the first one who put sludge on the bag proudly, and then later renamed it Biosolids, and I guess now it's called EQ. I am proud to announce that this spring, Kellogg's has removed all the biosolids for the future products. And that is to save their name. So some of the old, very reputable companies are seeing that the writing is on the wall. And I'm not going to take up too much of your time, but I would say that I understand this is a complex issue with many components. All of us do a daily contribution, but putting this on ag and ranch land is not the answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lisa Bedrogi, and that is my final request to speak this morning.
Hi, good morning, Board of Supervisors. My name is Lisa Bedrogi, and I'm here this morning to present a solution. I did speak with Supervisor Teixeira a little bit about this, but I am proud to represent a team of professionals, and it really takes a lot of professionals in a number of disciplines to build the technology to do just what we're talking about today, to actually take those biosolids and convert them to fuel. Not only can we do that, but we can also dewater that sludge up to 80%, water that could go back into our groundwater basins. We could reduce our air quality emissions by reducing the trucks that are currently leaving the county to take that sludge material and convert it into other products. My hope is that the issue of land application of this product will become null and void in the next 4 years. So I do encourage you to adopt option number one and extend the interim ordinance and start the conversation so that we can come up with these innovative solutions. The company I represent is currently marketing this product throughout the state. They're based in Indiana, and they are currently working with Battle Creek, Michigan. They design, build, operate, and finance the equipment to municipalities and community services district. What I ask from you as each board representative, because you all do know me, if you would give me the names of the 17 sewer plants that contact individuals in your districts so that I can go out and begin the conversation and see if we can't develop a win-win solution. I will send you some more materials on it. There's an extensive flow chart that will show you the process and how we can convert these biosolids into fuel and build a better community. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bedrogi. Having no more requests to speak, we'll close public comment at this time and bring it back to the board. Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rich, what do you see down the line in terms of if we go with, which I'm assuming we're going to probably support staff's recommendation and the first option, to continue with an interim ordinance, what danger do we see in doing that in the length of time that we're proposing here? Is there other influences that may change the way we want to do business here by having an interim?
Since the so-called interim ordinance has been in effect so long, so far so good. So as far as precedent setting, it looks like we're doing a pretty good job at protecting public health and the environment. We're hoping that the scientific studies that are in progress and yet to be done in the next 3 or 4 years will really shed some light and help us come up with a permanent ordinance that would serve all the stakeholders. And so that's our hope.
Well, I'm really intrigued by Ms. Bedrogi's comments about what the potential could be. And I have to agree with a couple of the speakers that said that we needed to address the issue of what we have here, because basically we're pushing it off on somebody else, and we don't want somebody else to push it off on us. So I think we need to take care of our own, not allow that.
Correct.
And so at some point, I would assume that we're going to be influenced by outside sources somehow. And I'm not sure how we're going to be able to address that other than by those two contents, the content and numerical limit.
Well, you'd be surprised at how many companies and counties look to see what's happening in each other county. And so they're always tracking to see what's happening. And, of course, the Kern County situation shows us that banning biosolids is apparently not the way to go. It's going to cost Kern County a lot of money for legal fees, and they'll probably end up losing. It's going to be tough for us to limit what can come in here. We don't have a large industrial base, so we don't have those nasty chemicals and toxins that some of the large counties do have, and so that's a concern. How we can address that, I think that will be key as we work now, between now and 2017, to come up with a long-term effort that would limit what could come into the county, if at all possible.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Meacham's touched on a number of themes here that I think we need to craft into our a motion and direction here. And it's quite clear to me we do need a permanent ordinance, a long-term solution, because we have here a fundamental recycling and reuse challenge. It's just the way it is. I guess as I look at it, I'm certainly supportive of extending the interim ordinance on a number of grounds, both the cost of the EIR in the face of a number of unanswered questions. So I think extending the interim ordinance makes sense. I would think that our direction to staff would be clear. To me, there are two components to it. One of them is, as we consider a permanent ordinance, I think we need to be very clear about a proper testing and monitoring protocol if we are to consider land application. And I was somewhat encouraged in the draft that's before us that there's a nutrient heavy metals management plan as part of that draft. I think that actually needs to be strengthened. I think it needs to be expanded in its detail, both the testing, the monitoring, the allowable application rates. And then I think on the other front, I think our direction to staff should be to work with our Integrated Waste Management Authority to research and evaluate alternatives to land application as a disposal for these biosolids. This is a solid waste disposal problem. And, I think we need to have those range of options on the table. And I think as we look at our budgeting process, I think this is such a fundamental problem that this board needs to be able to make available the resources to our Environmental Health Division to get these important questions answered. So that's the frame of where I think we should go today.
Thank you, Supervisor Gibson. Supervisor Arnold?
Yes, I want to thank the public for being here today. We had a lot of good discussion and a lot of good information brought forward, not just from staff today, but from the public. I'm excited and optimistic about the new technology that's moving forward. So I, too, would tend to support the interim ordinance to remain in place and while we are taking a look at other options that are just now being brought forward.
Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with Supervisor Gibson on the direction that we look to work with Integrated Waste Management Authority on technologies and a future capital project. And we heard Ms. Bedrogi mention that. And my own anecdotal reading of some of the things that have occurred, it seems like it is there is a possibility for this to be a very good capital project come the future. For a lot of the reasons that were mentioned, whether it be converting this to fuel or also providing a source of water that can be recycled and injected back into the aquifer. So And as most of us know, working with Bill Worrell over at Integrated Waste Management, nothing seems to excite him more than getting to check out new waste recycling technologies.
Especially in Europe.
Especially in Europe. Or Japan. I think he likes going
that's
there,
right,
too.
Yeah.
But I think that's a good idea, because I do think at some point we're going to need to come. We're going to need to look at how our own waste is being handled within our own community. And there are going to be probably, even as we get there after this is extended, probably more technologies available, and that'll give everybody a chance to look at those options. So, I think that that's a really good idea. So,
thank you, Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Teixeira. I want to follow up on Supervisor Gibson's comment regarding the funding aspect, which I think is important. I think if we start looking,
like somebody said earlier, we stop kicking the can down the road. We need to control our own resources and control our destiny. We've been pushing this off on other entities and into other counties, and we need to start dealing with them here. The thing that really excited me about this when we started talking about it was a tour we did in Paso Robles late last year, and the fact that the city of Paso Robles was having some issues dealing with their wastewater and their biosolids. And I think it's real critical that we not only deal with the biosolids, but our wastewater also. And with the EVC and the encouragement of bringing more business into this area, we're going to see more waste generated, and we need to be dealing with it here in our own county, and the county is the best place to start. So with that, I'll go to Mr. Buckshire.
Yeah, just thank you. Just a couple quick comments. Continuing with the interim ordinance would require, just so your board's aware, actually introducing the ordinance and then ultimately adopting it. So there are two more steps after this. This item today was simply to bring the issue forward to seek direction before we did any type of noticing of a formal ordinance. So I just wanted to be clear that you'll see this twice, two more times, if you move forward with the interim. And then regarding resources, certainly we can work with Environmental Health and Health Agency on options, and obviously fitting it into this budget schedule, depending how much information is available at this point in options, might be tight. Not to say that we can't do it, but given the time frame for the interim, I think we could look at either 13-14 or the 14-15 budget to build in some longer range plans for how to address this and how to fund it.
Thank you. I think we do need to start now, though. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I move that I move that we extend the interim ordinance and direct staff to prepare the necessary hearing items to do that. Further, to direct staff to develop a work plan and funding requirements to continue the consideration of a permanent ordinance with special attention paid to testing the constituents of sludge that might be applied to land sites. And second, to work with the Integrated Waste Management Authority to evaluate and research alternative techniques for biosolids disposal.
Okay. Second.
Okay. Madam Clerk, roll call vote, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Teixeira?
Yes. Thank you.
Break.
And thank you to staff. We'll take a 10-minute break. Be back here at 10:22.
Item number 10, consideration of a request to approve and adopt a fleet vehicle selection criteria policy for the purchase of county vehicles and to aid in the reduction of vehicle emissions, all districts.
Good morning. If I may just introduce this briefly. Sorry. Thanks. Dan Buckshire from County Administrative Office. Just wanted to introduce Mr. Rocky Boy, our fleet manager, which is a division of General Services. And I just wanted to provide a little bit of framework for this item that's before you today. About a year and a half ago, something like that, give or take, some of our departments, as part of the annual process to update the fleet, had requested some alternative fuel-type vehicles. And at that time, it was thought that we should have a more methodical manner in which to evaluate those requests with, which driving circumstances does it make sense? What is the total cost of ownership? Does it make more sense for some departments or certain types of vehicles than others? And Mr. Boy, in conjunction with some other departments, our office a bit, and others in General Services, has crafted what's before you today. And with that, I will hand it over to him.
Thank you, Mr. Buckshy. Supervisor Teixeira, rest of the board, my name is Rocky Bowie, and I'm the fleet manager here today to present to you the fleet selection criteria policy. The policy before you is part of the selection process as a whole. If I can, there we go. The total process when we go to buy a vehicle has to be first nominated for either replacement or maybe it's an initial purchase. Then we find the cost allocation, which has its own process, and then it's budgeted typically through the annual budget process. This year, for example, we have, I think, 70 vehicles on the initial request for next year. Sometimes this happens in the middle of the year, in which case we bring it to the board on a separate consent agenda. Once it's approved, money is set aside. When it's time to purchase it, the specifications are written by my office. I send it over to purchasing. Purchasing sends it out for a competitive bid process. From those bid results, we have a selected vendor to supply the product. And then, of course, it's ordered, received, and issued after the upfit process. Just to quantify the scope of this particular process, those of us who drive vehicles, which I sure is all of us, know that the acquisition cost of a vehicle is only a small part of the total ownership cost. So it doesn't consider any operational costs. The purchase price only represents a very small percentage. So as Mr. Buckshy mentioned, this started off a year and a half ago, and it's morphed through many, many different changes on the last year and a half. But when we keep peeling away the onion, we come up with the core issue is we need to implement a change in the primary change is to implement a life cycle cost methodology in lieu of the low bidder when we're making vehicle purchase decisions. So to consider life cycle costs, there's a lot of considerations. I've broken down into two different categories. The first one is the purchase price, which is your low bid price. It's not as easy as we would as civilians to go out and purchase a car because we're not just going to go off of MSRP or the sticker price on the car, on the Moroni sticker. We're going to go through the competitive bid process, and when our vendors bid this, they're going to be able to afford us some discounts that come through in vendor concessions. Municipalities typically get pretty good concessions from original equipment manufacturers, Ford, GM, and the like. And then the resale value is a huge consideration. If I pay $30,000 for a car and I sell it for $10,000, well, then my actual ownership cost to own and possess the vehicle was only $20,000, and that wasn't considered as part of the previous purchasing methodology. I'm going to illustrate these points and show you how it affects the change. Operational cost includes maintenance, repair, and fuel consumption. The big driver here is the fuel consumption, especially when we're averaging over $4 a gallon, and it's not going to go down, not too much anyways. Maintenance and repair costs are fairly similar between alternative fuel vehicles, hybrid vehicles, and standard gasoline-powered vehicles. They typically are somewhat less expensive, but the technology is advanced to the point now we really don't have any backup information. For example, the Chevy Volt hasn't been out but for 2 years, so we really can't speculate yet how much it's going to cost us over 5 years to maintain and repair the vehicle. Primary considerations when purchasing any vehicle is the capabilities. This came into play initially when the first hybrid vehicle I purchased for the county was a GMC Sierra that was going to be applied at the Lopez Lake area. In that particular case, the vehicle was a good fit because of the fuel economy. Obviously, it's operating in a stop-and-go environment within the confines of the park primarily. It has great towing capacity and carrying capacity because it's powered with a 6.2-liter V8, which is a very high horsepower engine. So it could tow up those hills and haul a good solid load. The other thing is this vehicle, as is the case with many hybrid or alternative fuel vehicles, can't be purchased in a stripped model. So in this particular case, you have to get it in a crew cab, which reduces the size of the bed. In this park application, it was a good fit. In sedans and vehicles such as that, it's very simple. It's not as complex. We start getting into larger vehicles, and it gets very, very complex. Vehicle reliability is a consideration, and that's because we have a lot of vehicles that are out there. Obviously, we're not going to purchase Teslas, but Tesla would be a good example to use. The technology is advancing to the point where we have manufacturers other than the big three and imported vehicles that are trying to get a footprint. There's a large company out of Phoenix, Arizona, another one out of Colorado, trying to get into the electric vehicle market. Problems with going with a smaller company like that is going to be the distribution of any kind of product support, parts and service, and reliability. We absolutely have an even more important goal than just transporting vehicle. As we have social services out there in the Carrizo Plains, I can't have them breaking down with a couple of children in the car. The reason we use vehicles is very important, and it's not just a commute vehicle, and that needs to be borne in mind. Travel range, electric vehicles, we're talking 70, 80 miles. CNG options, we have to keep this in mind because they're running maybe 80% of the travel range of the gasoline equivalent. Another consideration. Capital availability, this is a big one. It's going to come into play because vehicles are funded, as you know, through a reserve account that's managed by Fleet Services and our accounting offices. The reserve balance is managed at a dollar amount that should be enough to replace in-kind vehicles. And so if I purchased a vehicle a few years ago for $20,000, I should have reserved enough to purchase another vehicle for $20,000. The acquisition costs of hybrid and alternative fuel vehicles are often more expensive than the board in front of you. You have an example of a fiscal comparison using a life cycle cost methodology of a gasoline model Ford Fusion SE and a Ford Fusion hybrid model. If I put these numbers into the equation that's in the policy, we're going to see the acquisition cost of $21,700 versus $27,200. It's about a $5,500 increase in cost to purchase the hybrid model, and that's been cost prohibitive to this point. The resale value is better for the hybrid vehicle for a couple of reasons. One of them is the fact that the person doing the purchasing is going to also expect to get better fuel economy and be willing to pay a little bit more for that. But the real driving factor is, as I mentioned before, with the hybrid Sierra, is that you can't buy a stripped hybrid. This is going to be a better equipped car. It's going to be equipped with things that standard county cars we typically don't afford ourselves: power windows, power door locks, cruise control. So a resale buyer will tend to pay a little bit more for it. We'll recapture some of that initial cost. In the case of the Ford Fusion, I believe it's $2,500 recovered from the $5,500 initial purchase price. So our subtotal on our ownership cost is $10,000 versus $12,700. It's a much closer situation. The real change, again, comes into operational cost. The fuel alone is a $7,000 difference. We're going to save $7,000. This is assuming, by the way, a 50% highway, 50% city application. Mm-hmm. Maintenance and repair cost. Because the technology is so new, we don't have the maintenance repair costs for the more advanced vehicles. So what our industry recognized experts do, such as Edmunds.com, is they use the baseline vehicle. And unfortunately, in this particular case, they just use that and they don't have any adjustments to it. Typically, a hybrid vehicle or an electric vehicle, well, especially electric, a hybrid vehicle, the engine revolutions are substantially less to go the same distance because a lot of times it's either not running at a stop or it's running on battery power. So the engine oil, for example, won't need to be changed quite as often. And it adds up to quite a bit of money overall. The grand total in this particular case, the Ford Fusion Hybrid, which initially cost $5,500 more than the standard gasoline engine, ends up costing $5,000 more in the life cycle cost. Vice versa. Yeah, I got that back. So if you look at this one, it's kind of interesting because we initially paid, in this particular case, $21,700 for these cars, which, by the way, we just took delivery of 12 of these exact models, which is why I chose it as a one to select. The life cycle cost, total life cycle cost, has us paying an additional $10,000. And this could be a 5 to 8 year life cycle, sometimes longer than that, but typically 5 to 8 years. Where if you notice the hybrid model, the total life cycle cost is less than the acquisition cost. So the policy started out with a board member and people from the administrative office wanting to have a documented process to compare alternative fuel and hybrid vehicles. And all we've talked about is price. But because the illustration shown in the Ford Fusion versus the Ford Fusion Hybrid, we're going to end up selecting, in many cases, the alternative fuel. Actually, more often than not, the alternative fuel option. We're going to have a positive impact on the environmental side of the house as well. I think this policy is going to be well received because it does both. It saves the taxpayers money, and it also helps us preserve the environment. Set forth in the policy is some goals and objectives, one of which is the fuel consumption. And the policy asks us to mandates that I reduce in-class vehicles, that I purchase in-class vehicles with the best net reduction in vehicle fuel consumption, that I improve fuel economy 2.5% a year or 15% by the 2017-2018 FY. That's only 4 years from now. And the 15% reduction, I think, is a good goal to start with. And we'll address that here in just a second. Reduce emissions of carbon dioxide by 20% by the year 2020. Carbon dioxide is a known contributor to greenhouse gas, and it's ozone-depleting gas. This one's particularly friendly to me because we're going to reduce the emissions of nitrogen oxides by 35% immediately whenever we purchase a vehicle that is equipped with a diesel engine that was manufactured prior to 1999. There's nothing worse than on your morning commute than getting stuck behind some diesel as you reach to turn off your air conditioning or your heater to keep from choking to death behind that thing. So we're going to do this immediately. Monitoring and tracking is what is key to this whole thing. It's because the technology is advancing so fast. This is 2.5%. Improvement in fuel economy per year or 15% over the next 4 years may be a very soft bogey, but we don't know that yet. I've been doing a little bit of research recently on what's coming up in the last year. Just the changes in the last year are pretty. On a hybrid fusion versus a standard gasoline fusion, we're going to remove 16.4, or we're going to produce 16.4 metric tons fewer of carbon. So we have a financial advantage, and we have an environmental advantage. So we're going to reduce vehicle emissions produced by operating county-owned vehicles using a fiscally responsible methodology, preserving the environment while reducing the cost. Excuse me, I'm mumbling a bit here. This is a picture of the GMC Sierra that we first purchased. And I brought this up here because some people will have the perception, as Mr. Cuddy did this week, as he asked me a bunch of questions on the subject. Isn't it more expensive to operate a green vehicle than it is? Isn't that the general perception? And there's an article this morning on this fact. And the fact is, a couple years ago, that in fact was true. That perception was a fact. But in today's technology, with the higher price of gasoline and the lowering cost of technology, it's not the case in all cases anymore. I just want to take a point that we're very, very keenly aware that the money we're spending is taxpayer money, and that we know that we have an obligation to preserve the environment, but we also need to do it in a fiscally responsible fashion. And so I believe this policy goes forward as our first initial alternative fuel vehicle policy from the county to help preserve the public trust in that fashion. And with that, I would like to open it up for any questions you might have.
Questions or comments from colleagues? Ms. Arnold.
I just wanted to say that was an outstanding presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Just a couple questions for me, Rock. On the Tier 2 and Tier 3 diesel, with our reduction in the diesel emissions that you showed in your presentation, is that going to speed up the turnover on our larger equipment, saying so instead of going 15 years and so many hours with the Tier 2 and Tier 3 requirements for diesel, are we going to have to replace those more often and in a sooner pattern, so to speak?
Well, the answer to that is yes and no, of course, but the fact is we are going to have to replace them or repower them more often, but that was already mandated through the California Air Resources Board. What this policy does is it brings into our own policy some of their measurements, the 0.002 grams per brake horsepower, as an example. By having it in our policy, we can enforce our own policy when we're selecting a diesel engine. What I mean to say is some vehicle manufacturers, International Harvester, for example, has an engine out there that is being sold to municipalities under waivers. It, in fact, does pollute more than the 0.02 grams of particular matter per brake horsepower. But because it has waivers, it's available to be purchased. By having that measurement in our own policy, we don't have to accept that waiver. And we can say, well, no, but that's fine, but the County of San Luis Obispo says it's not going to pollute more than 0.02. Okay. So we will still have to replace it to be in compliance with CARB mandates. However, we will have more latitude to select the least polluting option.
Okay. Thank you. Supervisor Hill?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Rocky, on the improved fuel economy where we're edging up on our non-emergency about 2.5 a year to get to 15% by the end of... Is that the most aggressive? I wonder if you could provide a little bit more rationale. I know that we've seen even at the federal level across the board they're raising the CAFE standards. What goes into our thinking on that particular aspect?
Well, the 2.5% is a little bit soft because we're going to replace these vehicles over the next 8 years. And so we're only talking about half of our fleet being replaced over the next 4 years. So it's actually a 5% increase in the fuel economy in the ones that we are replacing on the average. In some cases, we won't see a lot of increase. However, in the cases where we are going to be putting an alternative fuel vehicle in there, we could see a 45% increase. One of the beautiful parts of this policy that I liked is the fact that our goals and objectives are reviewed annually. And so when we come back here, and we report it in the fourth quarter, by the way, so the fourth quarter report next year, we say that we've already hit 10%, then we know that we set ourselves a soft bogey and we can adjust that. I'm not trying to write myself too easy of a ticket here at all, but I don't want to set ourselves up for failure either. And again, the annual review will provide the proof.
And so that would allow us then, as the vehicles, because the federal standard is looking at about 54, 55 miles per gallon on vehicles by 2025. So as we progress and the industry progresses, we'll have the ability to purchase more, obviously, fuel-efficient vehicles.
Right, and I've been pretty proactive in recommending vehicles replacement based on age
economy, where we're tracking the fuel economy and the emission reductions of the fleet. But there are a few things, you know, he said he didn't want to write himself too easy a ticket. Well, that's what supervisors are for, I guess, because I've got a list of things that I think that we should add to the list of things for fleet to be considering. One of the issues that is mentioned in the staff report, Mr. Bowie, is that at this point we're not putting a dollar value on carbon. And we talked yesterday about the fact that through CARB, we do have a market in carbon right now. And I was interested in your response, and we had a little dialogue on where I think we need to go on that. I wonder if you wanted to comment on that issue.
As politely as I could, I disagree.
You did agree. I appreciated that.
The initial draft, or at least one of the drafts, a previous draft to this one, it was going to be coming in front of the board as the fleet emission reduction policy rather than a selection criteria. In that one, we were going to recommend the monetary valuation of carbon be placed on our fleet at 7%. And there is no national or international consensus on what the monetary value of carbon should be, but 7% seems to be the one that's being hashed around the most. It's been accepted in some levels on facilities. Air conditioning, refrigeration, ASHRAE is accepted at 7%. I've even looked internationally. I've read Her Majesty's environmental report, and they don't have a consensus either. So to include that in the a section of the county government that just focuses on fleet specifically, I thought would be a little bit short. I'm going to manage the fleet as directed by you, the Board of Supervisors, and the taxpayers. And if you tell me that you want to put a monetary value on carbon, then I'll be more than happy to include that. And whether I personally support it or not is not even an issue. I think narrowing it to our fleet is short. I think if we're going to put a monetary value on carbon, then it should be in the EnergyWise program, and then it should apply to all facilities, fleet, and did not just single out fleet specifically. I know the fleet is a huge contributor, but we're also going to come out here and then do what we can to knock down our carbon footprint.
And within our very respectful discussion of this particular issue, I think it is important for us to get a value on carbon, and one of the thoughts I have is we need to move forward on that. In terms of the fleet experience here, I think the main reason is understanding that allows us to access rather sophisticated programs that are developed at the state level through the Air Resources Board. And there are credits available for going to alternative fuel vehicles specifically aimed at fleet. A lot of push to get both zero-emission vehicles and electric vehicles into fleet operations, and we understand the performance requirements that we'll have to gauge that. But it's my suggestion that we need to understand those things that are going on at the state level. It's part of California Air Resources Board's low carbon fuel standard, a fundamental aspect of implementing AB 32. And, you know, in essence, as I understand that program, we can do greenhouse gas reduction for profit here. We can lower county costs and do greenhouse gas reduction, and I think we're seeing the first steps of that. So that's one thing I'd like to add into staff recommendation here. Second is I was very interested to be sure that this policy, we pass it forward, starts affecting our vehicle acquisitions now. And in particular, Mr. Bowie was talking about our upcoming budget cycle in the 13-14 budget. There are, I think you said, 70 vehicles potentially looking for replacement. I wanted to be sure that this is active now. And we were talking about the amount of money that's been allocated for vehicle replacement. I think we need to look at that carefully in light of this policy that I hope that we move forward on. And understanding the increased acquisition costs, but the improved life cycle costs, I think we need to look at how many vehicles, and we should be acquiring only those with the high fuel efficiency and the low emissions. So I'd like to review where we are in terms of vehicle replacement in this budget upcoming. And related to that, somehow, I would like to see fleet do a further review of the actual utilization of our vehicles, both looking at things like, are we speccing the performance properly? Are we buying the right amount of performance in these vehicles? And are we getting the right mileage usage out of these vehicles as the car ages? I know we have some relatively high mileage per month vehicles and some lower mileage per month vehicles. And the question of car sharing is really at a fundamental question of saving cost for our overall fleet. And there are private sector entities that are doing car sharing.
I don't know. I'm not sure why we need to put more into this at this point. This is the first time we've done it, and I think he's done a great job with it.
He has done a great job. I'd have him respond to some of these questions as well.
Ms. Arnold.
Mr. Bowie, I appreciate, as I said, your presentation, but how thoughtfully you incorporated safety, utility, value, and environmental stewardship. So I think it's a perfect combination. Clearly, you're doing what you can with the emissions, and as technology advances, you're going to be right there for us. So I was just very impressed with your presentation.
Supervisor Hill?
Yeah, I would just to clarify, I think that moving forward with the policy is a good idea that the Rockies worked on with, you know, and I think Supervisor Gibson has some good points in looking at some other ways that, we might be able to enhance it as we move along, partly because both policy and technology are continuing to progress, and I think it's only in our interest to make sure that we, I do agree that with Supervisor Gibson that it's good for us to be ahead of things. I think that's where Rocky wants to be for our fleet as well. And Rocky, how many vehicles approximately do we have in our fleet? Do you have a sense?
If we incorporate everything, Public Works fleet, everything from right. Backhoe all the way down to the smallest sedan, we have about 944 pieces. Right. It doesn't count the ones that are county-owned, operated by CAL FIRE. That's separately managed. Right.
So we have, you know, obviously we are a significant buyer of vehicles of every kind. And even in the larger equipment areas and truck areas, there are continual advances in those things. So I think it behooves us to, and Supervisor Gibson seems to want to volunteer to work with Rocky on this as they continue their discussions. I think that's, you know, I think his direction's good, and we can go forward with the policy that we have. And I would, I guess I would fold that into a motion recommending that we do approve this. As brought to us with and I think Rocky and
appoint Mr. Gibson as the
as the point person working with Rocky who may be mad at us for doing so.
He doesn't look like Mr. Iacocca though.
The automotive nerd.
Right, right.
Yes, I take the nerd role very seriously, Mr. Meacham. I'll second that motion and be happy to clarify where I think
we've
go forward.
We've still got comments.
Sure. Okay,
Mr. Buckshy.
Just briefly, I just thought I'd add a couple things. You know, one of the things that was interesting as this analysis was worked through is when we initially began on this, maybe part of the value of it taking a little while to work through is that technology has advanced in the year and a half. Because essentially what we were looking at initially was if it's going to cost more to have a more environmentally friendly fleet, and given our budget constraints, the question we were looking at is really what is the threshold from a policy perspective your board would be interested in paying more to have a greener fleet? And what this study has suggested is that dynamic's not really at play. You know, what I heard is that it seems as if possibly the majority of the vehicles that we'll be replacing could be done so with an alternative fuel vehicle, and yet the total life cycle cost would be less, which I think is a great thing. It's a win-win. You know, of the three requests that Supervisor Gibson had, I think, you know, wanting this to take effect now for 13-14, you know, certainly will work with Rocky and his team, but I think that's feasible. You know, it's not as if we pull the trigger on all vehicle purchases day one of the new fiscal year. They're phased in throughout the year, so I think that's very feasible. You know, further review of utilization of vehicles, that is something we've been focusing on, and we can certainly have further discussion if, you know, car sharing or other options are viable. You know, I think the one that's going to require maybe a little more work to dig into would be the dollar value on the carbon reduction, and that's a bigger picture, longer-term thing, which, you know, we could work on concurrently with what's in place here.
And if I...
Like Supervisor Gibson's going to do that.
Absolutely. I lost my last nerd project. You know, it's off my list. So, you know, I appreciate Mr. Buckshy's response on this. He's articulated those things that I thought were important. I think the question of dollar value for carbon is really the question of how this county accesses the carbon intensity credits and the zero emission vehicle credits that are available right now. So, it's, you know, Rocky and I can kick around numbers for what a ton of carbon's worth, but that's sort of beside the point. What I would like, and it's really an admin job, I think, is to see how can we maximize our, you know, cost effectiveness of getting the job done. So along those lines, I think what Dan's articulated is exactly the direction that I was hoping for.
Okay, good. Further comments, Mr. Gibson, Mr. Meacham?
I just have one question. Okay. Rocky, when you did the comparison between the resale value of things, have we turned in any hybrids?
No, sir. However, I have talked with other fleet managers within the state, and the return on the hybrids are almost double what it is on a standard vehicle.
Which with the price of gas?
I use industry recognized sources such as KellyBlueBook.com and Edmunds.com
to approve the criteria with the three options provided by Supervisor Gibson.
Right, staff recommendation with the direction.
With direction.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Good job, Roger.
Thank you.
Really good.
And we do not have closed session today, so we'll adjourn till 1:30 for afternoon session. Thank you, Madam Clerk, and we're going to move right into our afternoon session, and we've got presentation calendar and a couple hearings. If I could have a motion to accept the presentation calendar.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. Okay. We got
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold? And Mr. Teixeira?
Yes. Thank you. Our presentation today is for the AmeriCorps Group. Ask Patrick, is it FINA? Is that correct? To come forward.
Resolution proclaiming March 10th to 16th, 2013 as National AmeriCorps Week and honoring the Cal Poly Volunteer Infrastructure Project AmeriCorps Program. The following resolution is hereby offered and read. Whereas the AmeriCorps was created in 1993 under the Clinton administration through National and Community Service Trust Act to create a nationwide corps of citizens dedicated to national service, and whereas in September 1994, the first class of AmeriCorps members, 20,000 strong, began serving in more than 1,000 communities, and in July 2003, President Bush signed the Strengthen AmeriCorps Program Act, which nearly doubled the number of AmeriCorps members, and whereas the Cal Poly Volunteer Infrastructure Project AmeriCorps Program was established as a local AmeriCorps program at the Cal Poly Community Center and enrolled its first members in August 2010. And whereas the Cal Poly Volunteer Infrastructure Project AmeriCorps Program has made a meaningful impact in addressing community needs, assisting nonprofit and community agencies to administer high-quality programs and services, and whereas March 10th to 16th, 2013, has been designated as National AmeriCorps Week and local corps members will recognize this event by participating in community service projects throughout the county. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim March 10th to 16th, 2013, as National AmeriCorps Week in San Luis Obispo County and honors the Cal Poly Volunteer Infrastructure Project AmeriCorps Program.
Does anybody have a camera? You want your group to come up here?
Let's do it.
So you don't have authority.
Let's get the young people up here.
Yeah.
We just need one person with a camera, and then we're good.
If there aren't 24 cameras there, I'll be stunned.
To figure out how to.
Okay, we're going to have to start getting them lined up.
Get some tall people in the back and some less tall.
I think those group things of Wow Week, you know? You guys, real friendly. Go on, three rows.
Move in for the group hug.
Three rows, feel the love.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you for reading all of that. I know AmeriCorps kind of has its own dictionary in a way. So first things first, I have to be honest. I am not even a San Luis Obispo native, let alone California. I've called New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Georgia all home at some point. But in my short and pretty inexperienced life, without a doubt, the community I wanted to give back to the most was San Luis Obispo. But more on that later. Let's start with the big picture of AmeriCorps. At the national level, it's been endorsed and supported by Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And if you look into the details of all of their presidency, their platforms, the things they supported, really only the other unifying factor is they all agreed they were president at some point. At the California level, since 1994, more than 100,000 California residents have served more than 110 million hours under AmeriCorps. That means more than 340,000 people of all ages and backgrounds are helping to meet local needs, strengthen communities, and increase civic engagement through national service in California, with more than 1,800 national and local nonprofits, schools, faith-based organizations, and other groups, citizen tutors, mentoring children, supporting veterans and military families, providing health services, restoring the environment, responding to disasters, increasing economic, and not to toot our own horn, but our Corps has been known to go above and beyond our goals. They're a fun group, by the way. And while I could talk numbers to you to justify the impact AmeriCorps has, a far more effective use of time is to reflect on the culture shift that AmeriCorps represents within our community. A national study says that 3 out of 4 United States citizens indicated that they do not take the time or energy to volunteer in any capacity. That means roughly 75% of our country can't spare time, effort, energy to make a difference in their community. And that's why AmeriCorps is so essential in San Luis Obispo. The volunteer infrastructure project relies upon our skills and prowess to engage individuals within the community when faced with disinterest. We challenge the status quo and invigorate others to make a difference and change our culture, shifting apathy to energy. This is why San Luis Obispo is the community I picked when I graduated from Cal Poly with a Bachelor's of Science in Environmental Management and Protection. The inherent ideal of Cal Poly is learn by doing. And for me, the thought of doing immediately invoked images of translating my college experience into making a tangible difference within the community. I could have done things, working for a private environmental consulting firm and making a great salary, as my parents remind me on a weekly basis. But this is where AmeriCorps really came into play. The last statement of our pledge as AmeriCorps members is, "I will get things done for America," which is what I wanted to do. I could have done AmeriCorps in any number of cities, from Alaska to Alabama, but I wanted to stay on the Central Coast because of the incredible work ethic and passion displayed by our Corps. We have members that truly are able to take situations and problems and take things that look like aluminum foil and make them look like 24-karat gold jewelry. The individuals I'm able to work with on the Central Coast truly inspire me to reach higher and work harder on a daily basis. In summary, AmeriCorps for me makes San Luis Obispo what it is, my home. It was not now until I began my term of service that I started referring to this county as my home and Savannah as to where my parents live. My mom's still not okay with that. But unlike where my parents live, here in San Luis Obispo, I was able to do something incredibly unique and unlike any other opportunity that presented post-graduation. I could take my learn-by-doing education and start getting things done for America. Thank you for your time.
Patrick, thank you and your fellow volunteers for what you do in our community and around here. Thank you very much. Supervisor Hill.
Yeah, I just wanted to echo that and thank everybody. Nothing's more inspiring than to see young people who are already committed to serving their community, to serving the public, and to improving the lives of the people in their community. So thank you for being here, and thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you. Supervisor Meacham.
Just quickly, I noticed that you had VIP on your shirts. Some would call that very important people, very important person. Volunteer infrastructure project, they call me a very impatient person. Thank you for what you're doing.
Supervisor Arnold.
Yes, I just want to echo my colleagues in thanking you for all you're doing, and it's great to have you here today.
And Mr. Chairman, I do believe this is the biggest crew of AmeriCorps we've had in here yet, and it's good to see that it's growing, and appreciate your energy. Thanks.
He said they had 24 volunteers, but he counted 27, so there's a couple of extras in there somewhere. But thank you for coming, and thank you for your support. Madam Clerk, would you introduce the next item, please?
Item number 13, a hearing to consider the 2010 through 2012 biannual summary report of the Resource Management System, RMS, that summarizes the condition of the following resources throughout the county: water supply and systems, wastewater treatment, roads and U.S. Highway 101, parks and schools, all districts.
Thank you. Ms. Griffin, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is a very, very hard act to follow. And our presentation, I can probably guarantee you, will not be that interesting or entertaining. I apologize in advance.
Do you have your VIP shirt on?
I don't.
Okay.
Cami Griffin, County Department of Planning and Building, and this afternoon we are here to present our biennial report, annual resource summary report. And this is the first time we've presented the biennial report. This is going to be a look back over 2 years. In the past, we have done this annually, and 2 years ago, your board said, hey, change that to every 2 years. So this is the first time we'll be presenting a two-year report. We are missing our project manager, James Crusoe. He is out ill today, so we have a wonderful step in with Mike Wilkin, who will be doing the staff presentation.
Thank you, Cami. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name is Mike Wilkin with the County Planning and Building Department. We're described by region. We've got North County, South County, and North Coast. And then within each region, the resources are described by community. And then for each region, there are resources which can't really be easily addressed by community. Those are things that go beyond the community. For example, groundwater basins and air quality, regional parks, school districts that serve several communities and rural areas, for example. And those are in a regional resource section that's at the back of each region section of the report. And so actually, since those resources that I mentioned don't really lend themselves well to being dealt with by community, it kind of argues more for a resource-based organization of the report, which is actually the way it was a few years ago. So staff is going to be considering doing more of a resource-based organization of the report. In fact, the board directed staff to consider several revisions to the resource management system a few years back, and this year we'll be coming back to your board with recommendations to revise the resource management system. We'll be looking at the criteria for when you establish different levels of severity, and we'll also be looking at various streamlining and process improvements to the resource management system. And these are the resources that the RMS deals with: water supply and water systems. That would be the infrastructure like storage tanks and pipelines, for example. Wastewater, wastewater treatment, roads, schools, and air quality. And recently, your board directed staff to add parks and highway interchanges. In fact, parks has actually always been in the resource management system, but now we are addressing it more fully. And there aren't really too many changes in the levels of severity this time around, and they're summarized on the screen. A couple of road changes to the LOS for roads: Los Tablas Road in Templeton, the LOS is being removed, being recommended to be removed, and Halcyon Road south of Oceano, the level of service is recommended to go from 3 to 1. Those are due to the latest traffic counts that we have, showing that those roads are operating satisfactorily. And then we're recommending that in Cayucas, the CSA 10A water system go from a level severity 3 to none because of pending water system upgrades to the water lines and storage tank. And then the ozone level in the Pomo is being recommended to have the LOS-2 removed, and that's because there haven't been any exceedances since 2008 in that area. I should note, though, that is for ozone, not particulates, which is actually probably the bigger issue out there. And in fact, with the RMS revisions that staff will be coming back to your board with later this year, we'll be looking at maybe establishing an LOS criteria for particulates. We don't have one right now in the general plan. And so really a couple of issues have surfaced this year, one in the Pomo and one in Cambria. And so I'll discuss those and then the recommended actions for those two areas. First of all, on the Pomo Mesa, the groundwater basin there is part of the larger Santa Maria groundwater basin. It's at a level of 3 severity for water supply. There have been a number of conservation measures taken, especially by the services district, and the water demand has decreased. A technical group has been formed by the water providers out in the Mesa area to monitor the basin, and the technical group's latest report states that potentially severe water shortage conditions continue to exist in the basin, and the report recommends that a supplemental water project be implemented as soon as possible, which is being pursued by the Napomo Community Services District. The county, which isn't a water provider out there but has land use authority, has a number of land use measures in place to address the water issues in the basin. There are outdoor water use standards, for example, for new construction. There's a retrofit on sale ordinance. That's where you have to retrofit toilets upon sale of dwellings. And there's a per toilet fee for new construction, which goes to fund water conservation programs by the services district. So besides leaving the LOS 3 in place and the fee for new construction in the Napomo area, staff is recommending the following actions for the Napomo Mesa area water situation. Consider ending the retrofit on sale ordinance. Actually, that is proven to be not that to the basin or to the area. And then the other issue that is arisen has to do with the Cambria water supply. And just a little bit of background first on that situation. The Cambria CSD has enacted a water emergency and has been under a water moratorium for over 10 years, and since that time, little new development has occurred in the area. The county has reflected the CSD's moratorium with a level of service, level of security 3 for water supply, and I believe that's also been in effect for about 10 years or so. Cambria has enacted water conservation measures, and they're considering additional conservation measures, which are described in a report known as the Madaus Report. And the CCSD is now considering issuing a limited number of intent to serve letters for new development. In order for that to occur, a few things would have to happen first. First of all, the services district would need to address its own water emergency and moratorium, which is the county's level of service, level of severity 3 reflects. The CCSD would need to be the lead agency on that, the staff believes, and they would need to prepare the appropriate environmental document. Now, the county would collaborate with the CCSD as the responsible agency and would work with them to help prepare it. And then the county's growth management ordinance would need to be revised by your board. Currently, the growth management ordinance has a 0% growth rate for Cambria, and it would need to be revised in order to reflect Cambria's proposed program to issue a limited number of intent to serve letters. And the county would need to prepare an environmental document for that action of amending the growth management ordinance. And the idea is that the county would use the CCSD's environmental document that they will have prepared for addressing their moratorium. The LOS 3 that's in place for Cambria's water supply would not need to be changed at this time. In fact, it really does not preclude the CCSD from proceeding to address its moratorium. We have other basins in the county that have a level of service 3, and there are not moratoria in effect in those basins. So it's the LOS 3 really does not mandate a moratorium, and it doesn't preclude the CCSD from proceeding to address its moratorium if it wishes. And so the recommendations then for Cambria water supply are to leave the existing LOS 3 in place, collaborate with the CCSD on its program to issue a limited number of intent to serve letters, collaborate with the CCSD on its environmental determination as a responsible agency, and then collaborate with the CCSD later on to revise the county GMO to reflect the CCSD's program. Your Water Resources Advisory Committee has looked at the draft resource management system report. They provided staff with a lot of detailed comments, some of which we've already incorporated into the report. They've submitted a comment letter to your board. That's in attachment 2 of the staff report. Staff has looked at the comments, and we have responded in the following ways that are shown on the screen. We've documented the supply and demand data showing the sources of the information. We've more fully described the state water supply situation. We've used the county's master water report supply information. And we continue to work with Public Works and Environmental Health in trying to get additional providers on board in the program of reporting water information to the county. As I mentioned before, your board has directed staff to consider various changes to the RMS system that's outlined in the general plan, and we'll be presenting those changes to you later this year. And these are examples of some of the things we'll be looking at, primarily revising the criteria for levels of severity, for example, for water supply, to reflect the time it takes to plan and fund and actually build a project. The timelines that are in the general plan right now just don't adequately cover the actual amount of time that's needed. So those time frames or lead times need to be revised. We're also looking at revising the criteria for wastewater to match the criteria that the regional water. And so that concludes our presentation. We'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wolking. Questions for staff from my colleagues? Seeing none, we'll move into public comment. I've got three requests to speak this afternoon: Merle Cliff, Michael LeBrun, and Eric Greening.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Teixeira and remainder of the board. My name is Merle Cliff. I'm a director of the Cambria Community Services District, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of the elected representatives of the citizens of Cambria. For the past several months, the Cambria Community Service District has been evaluating previous projections of water use compared to the actual water use over the past 10 years. The fact is, during the past 10 years, the CCSD has never exceeded its water allocation. And during the past 5 years, the CCSD's average use has been only 86% of the amount determined by the U.S. Geological Survey to keep our water basins in balance. Now, the USGS determination of balance is considerably less than what our allocations are. Actually, it's 30% below our actual allocations, and we're using only 86% of that amount. Now, based on this information, the CCSD Board of Directors unanimously recommended the county reduce our level of severity from level 3 to level 1. The report before you today contains county staff's recommendation to retain the level 3 without providing any supporting data to counter the CCSD's recommendations. Now, obviously, the CCSD has concerns with the staff's recommendations. We have had some meetings with staff and Supervisor Gibson, and it appears there may be a pathway to compromise. I'm asking and requesting that the board postpone any action on the recommendations for Cambria and give us some time to meet with staff and see if we can solve these problems. We think that further discussions on the subject can quickly solve the problem, and we're confident that they can be revised and resolved within a short period of time. With that, I will let you know that we have other members of our board and our general manager here, and I will remain and will answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cliff. Questions for Mr. Cliff from the board?
Mr. Chairman, I think we'll get into a little bit of discussion on how to move forward on this after public comment.
Got it. Thank you. Michael LeBrun, followed by Eric Greening and Mahala Burton.
Thank you, Chairman Teixeira. Good afternoon, members of the board, members of the audience. Thank you for the opportunity to address your board today on this very important topic. I am Michael LeBrun. I'm the general manager of the Napomo Community Services District. I'd also like to start off by recognizing county staff. The county planning department staff has made a very good effort at updating the report and reaching out to the numerous service providers out throughout the county and asking for input and data. And so I truly appreciate that effort by staff. The district would like to take the opportunity today. Your county planning staff's not recommending any change. We've had a level severity 3 for our water resources issues down on the Napomo Mesa Management Area or Napomo Water Conservation Area for a better part of a decade. No recommended change. The district would like to update your board and the public on our progress in addressing that level severity 3, and that is by the importation of a second source of water. Currently, the entire Mesa area is 100% dependent on groundwater, and the district has been working for a number of decades, actually, and we're making some significant progress. Last May, we had a failed funding vote. We are attempting to build a 3,000-acre-foot project at that time and to fund the capital construction of that project with a property tax assessment. Our customers and the other property owners who would have been who were being asked to fund that capital gave us a clear resounding no thank you, no property taxes please, no increase in our property taxes. And so with that failed funding effort, my board of directors took two parallel actions. First, they formed a supplemental water alternatives evaluation to bid on that project right now and scheduled to award that project this April, and that would be a 650-acre-foot project that would be scalable and bring up to 3,000-acre-foot, which was that ultimate project that we've been proposing.
Thank you, Mr. LeBrun.
Happy to answer any questions.
Eric Greening, followed by Mahala Burton and Elizabeth Bettenhausen.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I'm mostly going to talk about water, but first I want to hit a couple of other things. I would suggest when you look at the criteria that in addition to adding interchanges, you change the category roads to the category transportation. Access to the community, mobility, should not just be the province of people with car keys or access to private automobiles. The whole transportation picture is something you as SLOCOG delegates have committed to, and I think the county's RMS should reflect that and findings should be made for all modes of transportation. Also, by making such a commitment, you show a commitment to improving our air quality, and I definitely do support including particulates in the air quality, what you look at for air quality, because the finding that there's no issues in the South County is at variance with your experience as APCD board members, where you have people with medical conditions coming talking about the impacts of the particulates. I would also remind us on air quality that it took some heavy-handed negotiating by our APCD staff to keep the entire county from experiencing the various sanctions that would come with being a non-attainment area. And so we're still skating on the edge and need to take those issues very seriously. On water, I appreciate the response to the RAC requests. We're still not completely there. It needs to be very clear with state water that there is a difference between allocation and supply. And I think the way it was laid out for Morro Bay is exemplary. If every other report could have the clarity that the Morro Bay report has on water supply relative to state water, that would be ideal. I have a couple of questions on water supply. In Shandon, to what extent the planned state water hookup is looked at as a solution, but to what extent does it actually fill the gap created by approval of the community plan? In the South County, what specific effects can we expect to Lopez deliveries from the Arroyo Grande Creek HCP? Are they currently accounted for in the numbers you see, or will they affect the numbers in some way? And relative to the Cambria request, the levels of service describe a situation directly opposite from Cambria's. In other words, one says, things are fine now, we anticipate a possible problem in the future, let's prepare for it. What Cambria is saying is they have plans to make the situation better. I think you need to not set a precedent for lowering a level of severity until you actually see physical results in plans and promises, not just because they exist. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Mahala Burton, followed by Elizabeth Bettenhausen.
Thank you. Mahala Burton, Cambria resident. I am requesting that this board approve the biennial summary report and not allow Cambria to opt out. I have great faith in the recommendations of the well-regarded Water Resources Advisory Committee and the Slo County Planning Department. Their decision, along with county planning staff, to keep Cambria's level of severity at 3 is based on the known water budget and past reports from esteemed agencies, including the U.S. Geographical Survey. That investigation into the two basins that serve Cambria took 3 years and included input from a large number of the riparian users on both creeks. Cambria's water supply is completely dependent on two shallow aquifers that must recharge every winter to carry the town through the dry season. We never know if there's going to be recharge, and often the dry season is very long. One time it was 8 months. It depends on creek flow and rain. The water diversion permits for Cambria are not set in stone either. The allocated amount can change due to priority users, riparian and habitat needing more water. Cambria even supplies water to state campground. Both watersheds have a viable steelhead fishery. The allowable extraction of water may be reduced by the State Water Rights Division Board if surface flow or the habitat pools go down. When Cambria declared a water code emergency based on a limited supply and instituted a building moratorium, they made a wise decision. Today, we still have the same limited water supply. Recently, Cambria approved 40 new affordable housing dwelling units. Also, a new 30-resident nursing home was approved. We have 30 more will-serve letters left over from pre-moratorium days.
Thank you, honorable board members. I've been watching you for 11 years on Channel 21, and I am grateful to the 21 people for making this possible. And also for one-seventh of my life, I've been going to CCSD board meetings. So I have been immersed since I lived in Boston and Manhattan in the charms of SLO, which I won't elaborate in 3 minutes. You have received my letter about what's before you today, and I urge you to approve what the Water Resources Advisory Committee and the Planning Department have so wisely put together. I think that collaboration between you and CCSD would only bring about three heads are better than one decisions and could only improve the situation. I would very much like to see a, quote, temporary small-scale pilot program, end quote, in your recommendations that you work out with CCSD to check whether this brand new, if I might say so, rather expensive conservation program is going to work. I think that we've probably well paid the consultant at $80-some thousand for his work, and at $300,000 a year, I'm wondering how much water we might have to use or fees gain to pay for this conservation program to test it out. So a small program would be very, very helpful, would cost a little less, and I would highly recommend also that you approve using the new affordable housing units, 40 of them, as that test program. I think we desperately need for affordable housing in Cambria, or as I, being a conciliatory person now, call it Cambria, because I don't want to take sides on that one. We can definitely use affordable housing, and we can use it more than anything else on the books yet. Test it out. Does it save water? And if the water is saved, is it wise then to sell it to new buildings? I'm mystified a bit by this logic, but I assume that in collaboration, you and CCSD can figure it out. I would definitely want to underline suggestions that have been made, and I did in a letter to the Water Resources Advisory Committee. I want to underline this. The judgment of efficiency of water use by a community should not be prospective simply and based on a consultant's model. The judgment should be made only after the plan has been implemented for at least 3 years. I've been saying this to CCSD at the meetings, and they have mercifully put up with me over this long decade. But I urge you to test out what is planned before making decisions to build the future upon what is not yet even a foundation, let alone shaky. Thank you very much, and you look much more real here than you do on TV. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bettenhausen. That's my final request to speak this afternoon, so we'll close public comment and bring it back to the board for comments. But before I do that, does staff have any responses to the questions asked by Mr. Greenian and the others.
Mike Wolken, planning staff. While I can't answer all of Mr. Greening's questions, he did have a suggestion about changing roads to transportation and looking at all modes, and that sounds like a good idea to us if your board wants to direct us to do so. Mr. Greening had a question about the Shandon water supply and I believe about the 100-acre-foot state water allocation, and that is not intended to fill the gap for build-out of the community. I believe that's intended for the existing community, not for future build-out. And the other question Mr. Greening had about Lopez and the HCP, I cannot answer that today.
Comments from colleagues? Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What's before us today is accepting this report, plus or minus a couple of details, and I've got two subjects I'd like to talk about there. But since we're here today, I'd also like to talk just a little bit about the RMS system going forward as it relates to this, the report that we have in front of us. Let me dive into the two that I have, and I'll do the simpler one first, and that's in Cayucas. We have a recommendation on the water system to take it from a level of severity 3 to no level of severity, and that's because the good folks in CSA 10A stepped up with a Prop 218 vote to replace a water line. We do not have adequate fire flow in the very high elevations of the south part of Cayucas, and these folks voted to go ahead and assess that. The plans for getting the necessary pipe upgrades are in place, but they haven't been put out to bid. And in fact, the fire flow hasn't changed at all. In addition, there's a storage component that speaks to the adequacy of the water system that is coming, is being worked on, a somewhat more complicated issue because it involves taking a permit probably through the Coastal Commission. So the district has presented us some important information that deserves our consideration as regards their water demand over the last 10 years. And I do support the idea that we continue our consideration of the proper level of severity for the Cayucas water supply. While we look at the numbers that the district has presented, they presented their demand numbers, essentially, their production numbers. We need to have our staff, I believe, look at this relative to their supply numbers, the USGS report that was mentioned, make sure we understand the assumptions. Make sure we understand also, looking forward, their conservation plan in the Madawis report that was referenced was just formally adopted by the district at the end of February. So I would like to propose to colleagues that we go ahead and approve the report as it is with, I'm going to suggest, the change in Cayucas that I just referenced, and that we then continue to talk with the CSD. The business of changing this particular level of severity in Cambria is a little complicated by its history, and staff can fill you in if you're interested, but basically a previous CCSD board declared the water emergency, and I think it's perfectly reasonable for them to consider the possibility of issuing new well-served letters under a conserve-to-build program. That's an approach that we use that's active in this county now. It's been used in a lot of jurisdictions. I'm perfectly open to seeing the proposal that they bring forward, and once they have a verified once they have a known system in place, a known program in place to issue a limited number of well serves, I'm happy to make sure we do everything we can to bring the building permits from the county land use side into that project. But I think it's a good idea to look at this in the big picture, both the change to the level of severity and the change to our growth management ordinance, which will actually issue the will serve letters. So those are my thoughts on the specifics of this report, and then again a couple of thoughts at appropriate point, Mr. Chairman, about the RMS system in general going forward.
Okay. Thank you, Supervisor Gibson. Supervisor Meacham?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regard to the Cambria suggestion, when you mentioned postpone the actions on Cambria, wouldn't it in fact leave it as it is?
It would essentially leave it as it is, but I think the RMS system and our record needs to reflect the fact that things are changing up there, and we need to be responsive to that. That's what I'm trying to do.
And that kind of goes along with my next question to you, Mike, and I'm pleased to hear that you're going to be coming back with the criteria by which you make the determination on these different levels of severity. And you said that won't be until fall. Is that what you mentioned?
It will be, Mike Wilkin, planning staff. It will be later this year. We haven't really scheduled anything yet. We're looking at releasing a draft in April, May.
Okay.
And so then we would probably be at the Planning Commission in the summer. And so it'd probably be towards the end of the year.
And will the level of severity criteria address all of the different parts of the RMS or just water?
We'll be looking at water in particular, but also some of the other resources as well, like highway interchanges and parks.
Well, when we get into the highway interchanges, I think it would be beneficial to talk to COG, Council of Governments, because they're looking right now at that Highway 101 mobility study, so some of those interchanges could be incorporated into that RMS. And then the last point I wanted to make is to reaffirm what Mike said relative to Shandon. That turnout for that 100-acre feet is not for additional build-out. That is, they wanted to secure that water for what is there now. Any other big projects or any projects like that, they're going to have to seek supplemental water through the state for that. Thank you.
Supervisor Arnold?
I just wanted to discuss a little bit more, going back to what Supervisor Gibson was saying and all the activity that's going on. This all seems to be going on in your district. But when you said defining what this report is about, and if I'm getting this right, it's kind of a snapshot in time, and there won't be another RMS out for 2 years. So I'm still a little confused. I understand Cayucas. You're asking that it remain at a level 3. It was recommended a level 1 because they have in their plans and they're going forward to change the fire flow pipe and some storage. And then that would, but at this moment in time, still a level 3.
At this moment, the fire flows are level 3
exactly.
As far as our previous.
And that's kind of where I'm going with it. If we're going to call this a moment in time, then straight out, it's a level 3. Nothing's changed right now.
Right.
But then when we talk about changed LOS numbers, we just change them, right? And so if we're going to be true to the report in this snapshot in time, and we talk about, then I'm just questioning, with all that aside, what really is the level of severity right now in Cambria? That's what I'm wondering.
Mr. Chairman and Supervisor Arnold, I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office, and I was part of a meeting with the CCSD about this issue. So let me start, and then the other staff can fill in if I don't get this right. The main reason that the staff's recommending no change in the LOS-3, of course, is because the Cambria Community Services District Board has declared a water emergency, and they have not lifted that water emergency. So we have testimony from them today. They apparently have new information. They may be looking at making some adjustment to that resolution of water emergency. They may not be. I don't know, but they haven't changed it. That was the basis for the establishment of the LOS-3. Our RMS provisions within the framework for planning state specifically that at the current point in time there isn't any particular requirement that triggers a LOS level of one sort or the other. It says specifically that it's all based on individual circumstances in the individual communities where those resource issues exist. And so I believe it was placed because of the water emergency, and the recommendation is because the emergency continues to exist. What we talked about was the fact that in order to move forward, the Cambria CSD board, or at least the people we spoke with, would like to have some sort of a signal from the Board of Supervisors that, perhaps they're moving in the right direction, and if there is a resolution to this water issue at some point in time, the board would recommend changing the level of service. And that's where the discussion of, well, perhaps, if you look at today's resource summary report on page 121, there's a long description of the recommended actions for the Cambria water situation. Perhaps we just don't adopt those today. We continue that part of this for some period of time to allow us to see if there are conditions that would get everyone to the point where some kind of an agreement could be reached on what the level of service ought to be.
Thank you, Mr. McNulty. Does that answer your question? Certainly.
Yeah, I just, in my continued discussion, then I'll be quiet. As a county, we're trying to put out a truthful report about what the resources are. We could be in a neighborhood where they just use excessive water and they're causing their own emergency situation. But in looking at it, I just want to, if we're going to bother with this report, make it be a kind of a true reflection of today's resource levels. And so hearing, unless it's a matter of validating the information.
Exactly. Okay. And that's where I would go, if I might, Ms. Arnold, mm-hmm. is that we've gotten some information about water production. Mm-hmm. I think the prudent thing for our staff in looking at the level of severity is to look at that and also analyze the USGS report, which is the report that tells us how much is okay to pump in that part of the world. Furthermore, they've just gone through an extensive process of looking at their water supply and the potential for conservation. That has been a very recently adopted report that our staff has not had a chance to look at. So it is absolutely about validating that, and I'm certainly committed to making sure staff moves forward in those validations. At the same time, over here, we have this sort of conflicting reality of them having a water emergency on their books with no change to the water emergency. So they're the ones who have said, well, we're not going to wish you Wilsers because we have this water emergency. So that's a little like the fact that nothing's changed in Cayucas, nothing has changed particularly in Los Osos until those plans are good. So we've got these two things that are sort of in conflict, and what I'm suggesting is that we just delay our further consideration of this. We're going to work as quickly as we can. The CSD has a number of steps that they envision in the near future as they look toward how they would put together a program to issue more WILSERS. And, we can come and change the level of severity anytime we want. I mean, when the pipes get in the ground in Cayucas, we could come back with a consent agenda item noting that that's been changed. The biennial part of this is the huge full review. But we can try to keep this updated on a case-by-case basis, and my commitment is to work hard with the district and our staff to get it to the reality that it is as we both take the steps we need to do.
And I totally understand, and I guess what's bothering me with this is I could see that, and Cambria, I mean, they chose to do this at some point in time, but the fact lifting a moratorium and lifting an emergency declaration, whatever y'all call it, could take a long time. And I'm just looking at our report. In other words, I'm envisioning people picking up a report and looking at where the resources stand, and I just want it to be as accurate as possible.
But they haven't done anything.
Well,
and so if they give us something to go on, then maybe we can say, okay, at that point, you've done something. You've taken an action. Maybe we should take an action.
I guess
what we have in front of us today is them saying, well, we realize we haven't done anything except provide some new information. Why don't you guys go ahead and act? And I'd rather have it the other way around.
The other way around. I'm just wondering if they ever can change this, or if it will take,
That I don't know.
And then we're still saying, you know what I'm saying? Our report is about, if it's strictly about resources and they're there, we should reflect that. And we could say, there's resources there, but they've declared a state of emergency, then they've never lifted it. So, and a moratorium. And we never change our growth management ordinance. We wouldn't be changing that. We would just be recognizing what I consider the truth. The water situation is not, there's been improvements. I don't know. Maybe it still is a level 3, and I would love to see the criteria updated. But the point is they may never be able to lift that moratorium or that emergency situation, and it wouldn't reflect the truth of the resources. You know, those are man-made legal words that...
Well, I think you're correct in identifying that it's not perhaps so much the level of service designation as the resource management ordinance limitation that's the big roadblock. Growth management.
Right.
Ordinance.
So that's all I'm trying to say is if we're trying to strive for a truthful resource document and just the level of severity number, I'm seeing that it's easily changed in some of the other areas of the county. I just wanted to reflect a truthful situation of the resources, really the resources. And then all the politics, that's a whole different story. And the legal, whatever goes on, is a different, completely different animal. But it's just a thought, so you all can take over with your comments now.
Supervisor Meacham.
Well, I guess just kind of following up on that line of discussion, and Tim pretty much hit on where I was going to go with it, I would assume that once that agency lifted that declaration of emergency, then the next step could be, from our standpoint, to say, okay, now that there's some steps being taken. That's why I think leaving things the way they are right now is a good thing until that takes place. If that community recognizes that there no longer is an emergency and they lift that, then we can revisit it. But I'm really anxious to see the criteria when it comes back to make those determinations as well. So that's it.
Okay. Got the staff light on. Is that you, Ms. Griffith?
That would be me.
Okay.
I just wanted to provide the board a little bit of information about the growth management ordinance because you will see it in the near future. There's a couple of amendments that we have to make every year. This year we're changing a fiscal year reference relative to the NCSD and also pushing the allocation date list for Los Osos out. It was this year's date. We're pushing that out a few years. So those very simple cleanup amendments to the growth management ordinance, they've actually been noticed for the Planning Commission. They'll be heard by the Planning Commission in April 11th, and then heard by your Board of Supervisors in May, end of May. We would not be in a position to make any changes relative to Cambria's 0% as it stands in the growth management ordinance as part of these cleanup amendments. That would have to come at a later time after all of these things we talked about today have happened. So I just wanted to clarify that so that when you saw those amendments to the growth management ordinance, you weren't surprised by them only containing these cleanup amendments that we do every year.
Okay. Mr. Gibson.
Mr. Chairman, I'll speak again in a second to my commitment to work with the Cambria CSD and our staff to get their issues resolved. But I'd like to go ahead and move that we approve the biennial RMS system.
Before you do that, I'd comment on a couple things in NPOMO, if I may.
Okay, absolutely.
Okay. Comments on NPOMO level of severity 3. It's been brought to my attention that the level of severity 3 in NPOMO was because of the Kona Depression that was formed out on the Mesa with the two biggest wells that NCSD is pumping out of and the well from Phillips 66. They're still pumping these wells, and so the level of severity 3 continues to be there. That's one concern. The other concern is the fact that the voters in NPOMO resoundingly defeated the pipeline, but yet the NCSD is continuing to pursue this project. And I'm afraid that we're going to have World War III down there because I get 3 to 5 phone calls a day with people upset over the pursuant of this pipeline project. And every time I go out in public, I get 2 or 3 people that accost me regarding this. And this is the same thing that we went in and had.
The refinery and the agriculture and all three of the golf courses up in the area, and that is because that is where the best quality and quantity of water can be produced on the Mesa. Unfortunately, as you move through the Santa Maria groundwater basin, the production zone, as you move north in the basin, and we are north of the valley, as you move north, the production zone moves to the west. Once you get up in the northern cities area, that production zone is frankly right along the coast. So the district feels we have very limited options as far as moving production around the Mesa. We do work with the Phillips 66 refinery. They are a member of the NMMA technical group. They are apparently welcome to some ideas for how they may shift their groundwater production to offset that and be a more efficient user of water. But we don't have any guarantees of that We remain a single source of water. We're the only purveyors. Those within the NMMA are the only water purveyors in the greater Santa Maria groundwater basin who have not participated in some form of supplemental water project, be it the Lopez or Twitchell Reservoir projects or the state water project. And so this has been an issue that, of course, through the adjudication process, which is coming to an end, Supreme Court, State of California has denied petition for review. So we feel that that case is near an end. That groundwater court that oversaw the case for 15 years recognized the stipulated settlement proposal, which included a physical solution, which is, in fact, an intertie pipeline to the NMMA from the Santa Maria Valley Management Area and delivery of water from the city of Santa Maria. So we know there are folks in our community that are not happy with that proposal. They don't feel it's been justified by the science and studies that have gone on for the last 20 years. But my board is steadfast, as they have been for 20 years of elected leaders in our community down there at the NCSD, and it is our number one option that we see.
Thank you. Mr. Gibson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to move that we accept this biennial RMS report with the LOS 3 for the Cayucas water system left in place, and with us continuing the consideration of the level of severity for the Cambria water supply. And further, that we direct staff to implement the recommendations of that they include in their staff report and the RMS report, and especially to continue work with the CCSD and this board to resolve issues regarding the level of severity at the Cambria water supply and the future of potential will serve issuances.
Great.
Second.
Great. Roll call vote, Madam Clerk, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
And Mr. Chairman, if it yes, might sir. Be appropriate, the general questions on moving forward with the RMS system, just very briefly. I don't know about my colleagues here, but I found some of the formatting of this particular report a little bit challenging as I tried to extract information from it. I know this is a work in progress. I had some conversations with Ms. Griffin about that. But just manage, this is a report that has a tremendous amount of information in it, and it was difficult for me to get it out in an easy fashion. So I would urge staff to continuing their considerations of formatting. Second of three points, I'd like to us also to consider how we, in essence, report success. How do we reduce levels of severity? Because that's the reason that this report's here. It's to identify problems, but I think we've got to be there solving the problems too. So I think we need some clearer guidance as to how we are going to remove levels of severity. And third, I think we need to consider, again, involving our partners region-wide. Last time this came up, I was suggesting that this might be a project we'd like to work with SLOCOG on, so that we have a better regional view of our resources, which do absolutely cross jurisdictional boundaries. I think that Mr. Greening's comment about transportation versus roads is one that SLOCOG is an absolutely obvious partner for us to engage. So my three thoughts on how we move forward with this.
If I may add to those three thoughts, I agree with you totally on the regional aspect of dealing with our regional partners, and I would include all of them,
yep.
Whether IWMA,
right.
APCD, any of the rest of them that we need to deal with,
districts,
we bring
whatever.
Them all in.
Yes.
And I'm glad to hear that you had problems reading this, because I did too, and I thought it was just me. So thank you.
Tough.
Okay. With that,
okay, never mind.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Meacham.